This week on Pop of Culture, we head to summer camp.
Getting a note from a kid and saying, this is the very first place that I got to be myself and no one made fun of me. You know, that's all I need.
We'll talk about the importance of education in the theater arts.
And later, we'll have our picture taken.
And I'm convinced that 80% of the photographers my age are photographers because of that movie.
Coming up,
Pop of Culture on IPR is made possible in part by the Indiana Arts Commission, the Community Foundation of Randolph County, the National Endowment for the Arts, Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations, and by sustaining members of IPR. Join us at indianapublicradio.org.
From Indiana Public Radio, this is Pop of Culture. I'm Jen Blackmer.
And I'm Kara Duquette. Later this hour, a jack of all trades.
But first, we're going to continue our conversations between the coasts. We've talked before about the importance of educational theater, so we thought we'd speak to two professionals who do just that. On the show today, we have Brent Marty and Holly Stoltz. And Brent is the Director of Music and Education at Booth Tarkington Civic Theater in Carmel, Indiana. And Holly is Director of Education Programs, also at Booth Tarkington Civic Theater. Welcome to you both.
Thanks, Jen.
Thank you.
We are so happy that you're here today. And I wanted to talk with you as Central Indiana artists and as longtime residents and also is as Director of Education Programs and collaborators for Booth Tarkington Civic Theater. And I know that the two of you have a long history together. Is that correct?
Yes, we do.
Oh, indeed. We met in 1906.
1906.
Yeah, all six.
Yes, at the teacher's college.
The normal school.
Normal school, that was it, yeah.
Yes. Brent loves to tell everyone how much older I am than he is. We're not that far apart. We were there at the same time. But yes, we met actually
1989.
When he arrived, I was actually out of the country. I was in China. Mm-hmm. So when I came back, Brent had all was there. But we did a summer show together. We did The Leader of the Pack. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of when it all began. Yes. Not kind of. I think it is when it all
is.
Began.
It is. Ball State used to produce a summer theater program every summer, professional. And a lot of us students at the time would stick around and perform in those. And Leader of the Pack and Anything Goes were the two shows that summer. And Leader of the Pack was first. And that's where we met. Ensemble.
Oh, that's excellent. So both of you have the word education in your titles, right? So Holly, when you're Director of Education Programs at Booth Tarkington Civic Theater, what does that mean? What exactly do you do?
Okay, so Brent and I collaborate, but I came up with this just recently, and I don't know why I'd never thought of this. In a traditional school system, I would be the principal. And Brent would be the superintendent. So really, I am boots on the ground, okay? I work with our teachers to make sure that curriculum is being taught the correct way. I set curriculum, help figure out the schedule. I go into the classroom and, you know, it's kind of that, oh, Miss Holly's coming, look out, right? and you never want to be sent to Miss Holly's office when you're in class or rehearsal. So I really am kind of that principal. I am that person who the teachers come to me with questions. I make sure that everything is running smoothly. And Brent and I together create curriculum, but I help implement it. And I'm in the classroom a lot too. Brent and I co-teach a lot of the upper level classes. We have a company, a junior civic company that the two of us teach and direct. But as far as like camps, these past few weeks, I was the administrator of all those, you know, mm-hmm. making sure everything was running smoothly. So I'm the principal of the school.
So tell us about the school, because the education program at Civic is one of the largest, I know, in the area, definitely, but how does it rate, you know, in the country? It seems like it's very large.
Yeah, so Civic Theater, if people don't know, Booth Tarkin Civic Theater, which used to be known as the Indianapolis Civic Theater, but our actual business title, if you look at tax records, has always been Booth Tarkington Civic Theater. And that is because Booth Tarkington, the author, the native Hoosier author, a founder of what it became. It was originally called the Little Theater Society, and we're talking 1914 here. So it's a long, long history.
But the Junior Civic for the education component started in 1941.
40s, yeah. So the education, the point being that there is a long history of education here too. It sort of goes part and parcel with a community theater model. Mm-hmm. We act as educators regardless of age. And through the last 80 years or so, we've been doing that work, you know, continuously and growing where we can. Moving to Carmel was a little bit of a shock to our system because we had served, being centrally located in central Indianapolis, we were serving all sides of the city. Moving to Carmel puts that at a little bit of a disadvantage for some people who can't get up here. You know, we don't have great public transportation in central Indiana. So that poses a challenge for somebody, say, who wants to come from Greenwood. That's not going to be an option for them. And if anybody's listening to this who doesn't know the geography of central Indiana, look it up.
Yes, but, that's south side of Indianapolis, yeah.
Yes, and so we have been able to grow and thrive, though, however, in the community that we are in because of the level of what the economic situation here is in Hamilton County. So, you know, we have grown, but we have also become sort of victims of, we don't really have enough space, even though we have this lovely facility. We could use two or three more classroom spaces.
Oh, sure.
So, you know, make it grow even more.
So what age ranges do you serve and what kinds of classes do you offer?
Mm-hmm. Holly, go ahead.
Well, we start at age 4 and we go all the way through, you know, 104. But my focus, Brent kind of spans all over the place, especially because he's in production. But my focus are those kindergartners through eighth grade. I like to, I get the garden ready, right? I till the soil, I plant the seeds, I fertilize, I take care of it. And then when they grow up and they bloom, then Ann Beck moves in and picks all the flowers. Yeah. So,
and I hire the gardener.
Okay.
I hire the gardener.
Brent sits on his lawn chair and drinks lemonade and maybe gets the hose out and waters everyone.
I wish.
No. So really that's what we do. But the classes. Okay. So we have something called creative stages. That's for our littlest friends, our kindergarten age, which incorporates, you know, movement and music and imagination and just really finding their voices. And we use children's literature. I buy children's books constantly because I just love it. And then when they get in first grade, that's first, second, and third graders get to do a traditional acting class or a musical theater class. As they get older, you know, as you know, I don't have to really tell you, Jen, or really anyone kind of understands this, you know, with the arts, you know, you can have an eighth grader who is very new and has never done anything and needs an intro level class, where we'll have a third grader who has done 15 shows and has played Annie already and has taken private voice lessons and has been taking taps since she was 5, you know, so they're ready to be pushed. So, it, you know, we have these intermediate level classes and then our advanced classes. We also do, you know, these are the same kids who can audition for our shows. Mm-hmm. I will say our auditions are open to everyone. We are a community theater, so you don't have to take a class to be in a show, but just honing your skills and as anyone, it doesn't matter. I'm on, you know, whenever I audition, I'm nervous, but when you go somewhere you're familiar with and it feels like a home, you're going to feel a little more comfortable. And we find that, but we get these kids ready. And then, you know, it's nothing for us to get a phone call from Beef and Boards or IRT saying, hey, we are really looking for this specific age range, this gender, this type. Do you have kids? And, you know, I can, with one email, just send it to 50 or 100 kids. And, you know, we know they're ready. And I'm very proud to say they call us because they know if they've been in classes here, that they're prepared in the correct way. Right. And so, you know, it's really rewarding.
And just to cap that, there is a focus here on process and technique development, and also the life skills that come along with just being an artist, a good human.
Absolutely.
You learn how to collaborate. Yeah. You learn how to work as a team. You learn how to speak up for yourself. You learn all of these other components that are going to help. So it's not just kids. We're not here to churn out little stars at all. Mm-mm. Although we have had some go on to greatness. You know, we have a couple of kids on Broadway right now. Mm-hmm. But it is more about just developing those young artist skills and storytelling. This is storytelling. At the root of all theater is storytelling. So in those kindergarten age classes, they're learning the components of a story, which also then, you know, lends to further them being able to excel in other learning environments.
Right, right. And I see the skills that you all are teaching these kids being useful in so many ways, not only just, you know, in making theater, but also just in, as you said, being good humans. Have you noticed kids changing at all over the last few years in terms of you know, being on their phones and on their devices? You know, how do you work with these new, you know, we'll say digital native kids? How has that evolved?
It is certainly challenging. And then there was something called the pandemic that happened that
of
really
course, yeah.
threw students into you know, a world of uncertainty, which, you know, I know that you as an educator also have learned this, but that's brought a whole nother level of, you know, how do we handle this social situation that they're now in?
Right. And for me, I think it also makes the work that much more urgent, right? Because of all of the things that our kids today have lost over,
certainly,
you know, the last several years.
So I think Holly would agree that we do our best to kind of get them away from the digital technology. And certainly it is useful in the classroom. You know, if I want to pull up a song or a video from, you know, Hello Dolly in 1972, you know, I can do that and show it and use it as a teaching tool. Or if they're learning a song and they can then pull out their phones and record their part and go home and work on that on their own. There are all kinds of wonderful ways to use that technology.
Yeah, there's something to be said, though, for holding sheet music, not an iPad, actual sheet music in a binder. And Brent's at the piano. Brent's at the piano. You know, it's important. They're not holding an iPad and hearing a track. When they come here, they have sheet music, old fashioned paper. And I know environmentally it's not always the best, but you know, it's just, they have their pencil and they're marking it. And then Brent's at the piano and they're singing to live accompaniment. You know, it's so important. And, you know, finding their voices and just collaborating and looking at each other, you know,
right.
I mean,
yeah,
just being in the room together and learning those listening skills. One of the, you know, we were talking about, there's the obvious things, public speaking, you know, and feeling confident and teamwork and collaboration. But one of my favorite things a parent said to me, and both of her girls grew up in our programs. I mean, literally from five until they were, you know, came back from college and still did things. One is an attorney right now, and the other is going to get her doctorate. She's a big research scientist.
I love that.
But she said, they learned how to deal with hearing no.
Yep.
And not no like us going, no, stop it. Not that. But auditioning and not getting a role. And as an 8-year-old or a 9-year-old, working through that, right? It's hard for a lot of people. It is difficult. And I'm always amazed when I can't believe I didn't get the part. You know, there's one part and there's 40 people. 40, you know, young girls trying to, you know, get this part, one person's going to get it. So not only do you learn that, you know what, I did my best, it wasn't for me. It's not because I'm not talented and I'm not valued and I'm not important. It just wasn't for me. You work through it. And then you also learn to be encouraging and excited for your friend who did get it. So there's just that, when she mentioned that to me, I had never really thought about that. And I think it's a really important lesson.
Yeah, and that's important in so many ways. I mean, we talk about teaching our kids resilience and teaching them how to come back from challenges and face challenges and deal with failure in a good way. And really, I mean, the arts are where that happens, and it's where, you know, we do, I think, the best work imaginable in that kind of a situation for these kids.
Yeah, and even in the classroom, I'm always saying this, the only way you're going to learn and grow is if you just keep failing. You've got to put yourself out there, you know, try to sing that note. Your voice might crack. What's the worst thing that's going right. to happen? Your voice is going to crack, and then you're going to learn to work through it, or you're going to mess up that line. I bet you won't do it again, you know, but if you stay safe, it's never going to happen. You've got to be vulnerable just like, no. You have to unzip completely.
Or if you are dealing in a world where you can take flaws and erase them on your phone, you know, or you know, in an electronic way, digital fashion, that's not real life. Not right now, anyway. maybe 100 years from now it'll be different. But you know, we are old school when it comes to that. And I think that we feel strongly that it roots kids in a way that maybe other ways don't.
Right.
Absolutely. And I also see, and if you could speak to this for a little bit, I think the work that you both are doing at Booth Tarkington Civic Theater is also filling a need in terms of arts programs at schools, which are, of course, the first thing to get cut when budgets are being, you know, dealt with. Music programs, arts programs.
Yeah. This is an area where I wish we were making more of an impact in communities that are seeing that happen. You know, here in good old Carmel, Indiana, USA, you know, top place to live in the country, blah, blah, blah. We don't, the schools here have thriving arts programs. And in fact, we compete with them in some way. Mm-hmm. Even the middle schools are putting on full scale musicals. I wish we saw more of that. And I know there is more of a need for that. But when it comes to, helping with, arts programs that aren't happening in schools, we don't see too much of
However,
that.
However, I'm going to say, though, the niche we do fill is this.
Yeah.
Because, like, the schools are so big, a student who would be the star and the lead at a smaller school can't even get into the show choir or the ensemble because there are thousands of kids. And the kids who are doing it have had private voice lessons. They've been to New York. They've done all this. You know, it is so affluent and they have so much. So the niche that we fill is that we get these kids who want to do this and hone their skills, but there were 400 people who wanted, you know, to get into the musical and they cast 40, right?
So they cast 140.
Those kids come to Civic and they say, "If when I'm at my school, I didn't have a chance to get in. I auditioned, but I didn't get in." So then they come here and they take class, and they're still able to. So that niche is being filled. It's not in the way that we think because things are getting cut. But the leftovers are just as vital and important and deserve to be seen and heard can come to Civic. And although they're not in their school musical, they are honing their skills while they're here. And then they find their home here. And they go through our programs and, you know, those important ones who just find their voice and light up when they're on the stage and realize that, you know, all the work they did paid off. And, you know, that's my favorite moment. Or getting a note from a kid and saying, "This is the very first place that I got to be myself and no one made fun of me." You know, that's all I need.
Yeah.
That's really all I need. You know, it's those are the kids that are so important because it changes their lives.
And isn't that a wonderful way to voice the topic of your podcast, Jen?
Yeah.
Like, really, it is. We are here doing what we do and having affected now thousands of children.
And making, if you said this too, that even if they don't go on to do the arts or be performers, they have the arts in their lives. And I think that's also a crucial point to make about arts education, starting at age four, as that's your program right. does, which
and
was,
then they
which
become,
is great.
Eventually they become patrons.
That's
and they're
right, yeah.
Kids, and they're supporting through the money that they're making in that corporate job, you know?
So hopefully.
We love that.
Brent and Holly, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you for having us.
What a pleasure.
Holly Stoltz is the Education Programs Director at Boots Tarkington Civic Theater in Carmel. Brent Marty is their Director of Music and Education. This is Pop of Culture. I'm Jen Blackmer.
And I'm Kara Duquette. We're here now with Jack Christian. He's an artist. He is also a recent MFA graduate from Ball State University and works in many mediums, including glass, metal, neon, and many more. We're happy to be speaking with him today. Welcome, Jack.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Of course. Can we start off with you telling us why you like to make things and a little bit about how you got started in art?
Oh, I think a lot of it stems from self-therapy. I was diagnosed with ADHD and a touch of autism in my later, like not until age like 47. So I think that my creative process really stemmed out of a need to just kind of channel and focus all this energy that my brain has. Mm-hmm. So I've been able to, you know, utilize that as a hyper focus. Really has been kind of a benefit and just kind of helped me out through my whole life.
That's very interesting that you share that with us. I want to ask what that diagnosis did for you with the ADHD and autism. Like, did that?
It's not. I guess it wasn't so much of a vindication, but it was a way to kind of like understand why my brain worked differently.
Yeah.
It was, I would say, more of an understanding, because throughout my whole life, I've always been different or been seen different or not really be able to interact in a you know, quote unquote, normal way with people. So art was always a way to kind of slide into society. You know, the quote that said, you know, beware of artists because they can fit into any situation.
Yes.
So that for me was like a very big moment in my life. You know, so instead of like seeing it as a blight, it's more of a beacon. You know, it's like enable to like utilize the things that my brain does differently than other, you know, quote unquote, neurotypical people. So it's, I see it more as an advantage than as a disability.
Oh, yes. I mean, as we learn more about neuro difference between people, I think we realize more and more that the spectrum is wide and it applies to everyone in different ways. I was wondering if you could, so with that hyper-focus and your desire to be in the arts, can you walk us down a little bit of your artistic path and some of the things you've done that have gotten you here today?
Sure. You know, I started my art journey the same way that, you know, most people do with, you know, high school, elementary school, you know, basic art classes. I've always been just a sponge for knowledge. So it's like, if you tell me, it's like, hey, no one knows how to do this and you want to learn. It's like, yes. You know, so it's always been a toolbox that I've been trying to fill with different skills. Now, I'm not proficient or an expert or a master of any one. I think the term is called factorum, you know, the actual technical term for a jack of all trades.
What did you say? Factorum?
Factorum. Yeah, it's we had a guest artist, Michael Fleckner, came in from California. and it's F-A-C-T-O-T-U-M, factotum.
Factotum, so okay.
So I've been able to constantly learn new things. And I think that kind of like drove my my making. You know, it's like just every time I learned something new, it just became another avenue to incorporate things. So I kind of in college started to develop the mixed media. So like, okay, you know, I could use this material and this material. And unfortunately, sometimes and this material, it kind of got away from me just because of the locking in and getting hyper committed to something, you know, not really seeing the end goal, just more about getting locked into the process. So I've, in the last couple of years, kind of like with graduate school, learned to kind of reel it in a little bit. You know, not everything has to happen all at once. It doesn't have to have the kitchen sink in it. So there's still elements of that because I'm aware of my my habits, but I've been able to kind of like focus a little better.
I've seen many pieces of your work that have elements that you were describing to us. Can you talk a little bit about a specific piece or series and like walk us through kind of visually what that might look like and the mediums you used and talk a little bit about your process?
Okay. I think probably I did a series and it was, this is on my, you can find this on my Instagram on The Art of Jack Christian, great, all lowercase, apparently. But it was a series of two, and they were found object dragonflies, so with neon wings. So what I had done is went out and collected just tons of objects. So between Goodwills, thrift stores, curb alerts, you know, just kind of collecting this large I call it a hoard, you know, it's like my wife calls it a hoard. It's also a collection because it's curated. But, you know, just kind of finding raw materials, seeing shapes, seeing objects and being able to kind of assemble them in my mind ahead of time of like, oh, this would make a good texture. This would make a good, you know, object or a good shape to kind of like get the basics down. And then I would go through and like build a wire substructure and then start assembling all these objects together. And if you looked at it before there was a primer coat on it, it looks like a mess. I mean, it's just, there's some process photos on my Instagram of, you know, there's a Boba Fett slave, one ship, there's a toy shotgun. There's like, little tiny traffic cones or 14 pounds of bottle caps, you know, so it's just a matter of curating all these things together and as assembling them. And then as it kind of comes together, you start manipulating those objects to kind of get the shape you're looking for. In this case, it was a dragonfly. And then we went through and bent the neon to be the silhouette shape of dragonfly wings and then wired it up so that it would have kind of a monochromatic look, spray painted with a flat white so that the shape became prevalent and not so much the object. But if you got close enough to it, then it's like, oh, there's a moment of discovery that they are, you know, the viewer can see as they get closer to it. You know, but initially it's like, oh, object, dragonfly. And then as you get closer, the core elements start to develop.
Okay. So yeah, it stands as a singular dragonfly, and then there are all these discoveries you make as you look at it more closely. You know, when you're talking about curating and assembling pieces, like what inspires you? Like, how do you get inspired, like to get certain things?
I would say most of it comes from just experience. I've been doing the found object art since 1989. So I was inspired by a National Geographic issue that there was, it was junk art, and the name of the artist, I'm embarrassed, it escapes me, but sometimes I'll find a bulk of things. So if I can find a lot of things, like objects inexpensively, I'm not saying Legos, but something where there's a bulk of them, I'll get those into the collection. Mm-hmm. And sometimes there's just a single object that could be taken apart. You know, it's like from coming from a place of abject poverty as a college student, the cheaper or the more things that have a purpose, or can be used for the end goal as a benefit. So Nerf guns have in tunnel a bunch of internal workings, gears, cogs, pistons. So that's like the prize inside of the outside shape. So you can start to develop and gain more pieces.
I think we can all relate to getting things at a discount, being a college student with not a lot of resources.
So you kind of have to make do with what you have. Sometimes I will make something and it's not working the way I want it to because I have this preconceived object in my mind. It's not happening because I don't have the right materials. But other times, by letting just it create itself in a way,
yeah,
you're just following along with the process. And the next thing you know, you have, oh, what's that look like? Horseshoe crab? Good, good. Exactly. That's what we're going to go with.
Yeah, sometimes when you let go, the materials just inform your creation. Can I ask you, what are you working on right now, or what are you planning to begin in the near future?
That's really interesting because with this move from, like when we moved to, recently moved from Chicago, the transfer up there was such a dynamic. We had moved from our house to 2,700 square feet, two-car garage that we couldn't put cars in because I had my studio set up in there, to partial part of a room on top of a sewing machine table. So that was my workspace.
Wow.
So when we moved back from Chicago, everything went into storage. So now I'm even smaller, but I just started this new position here where I do have an opportunity to work in the studio and at the Riley Building. So that's the Fine Arts Building.
You say here, and you mentioned the Riley Building. So where is it that you will have this ability to use a studio?
Oh, Riley Hall is the other section. Notre Dame's School of Arts and Letters has two sections. So there's the Design Building, which is where I'm at, and then the Riley Building is in the middle of campus. So having the difficulty of putting together my own studio has kind of been diminished, and I can just use some of the resources that are available here. So with the advent of CNC machine, 3D printers, laser, and plus all the other tools at my disposal, I really don't have an excuse. So I've been spending the weekends kind of like putting together my 10-point plans, you know, little cards of figuring out, okay, this is things I'm interested in, and using a technique that I learned in grad school called mind mapping. You kind of start with a circle and then you start adding little connections, like molecules of how to connect it. I'm still going to be working with the found object. So I'm going to be doing a lot of 3D printing and some laser cutting to make some my own raw materials, as opposed to having to go out and source these in the world. I think it's going to cut down on the amount of time that I'm spending scavenging, and then being able to use these objects in electroplating. So it's a process of using chemicals, electricity to plate copper onto objects.
Oh.
So that I can make my own metal objects without having to cast them. So I think that's the direction I'm kind of going in right now. The trick is finding a patron, finding some place to put this, which is always the case, you know, trying to find a place to install it. But I think South Bend is a pretty good opportunity. It's got a great history of the arts. You know, unfortunately, with some of the places that I live outside of the university setting, it's kind of difficult to step outside of the norm of what's seen as quote unquote art. Mm-hmm. So, you know, some galleries are reluctant to let you do a 6-month installation, but I think the arts here are really well supported.
Well, I just wanted to know if there's anything else you'd like to tell us.
No, I think this is a really great platform, and I'm really happy to have been included in it. And after going back and looking at and listening to some of the other podcasts, if it's correct. It's very exciting, and I'm very excited to follow. So if anybody has any questions, I'm on Instagram at The Art of Jack Christian, the at sign, TheArtofJackChristian. The Art of Jack Christian.
Okay, great. Well, thank you so much for joining us today, Jack.
I'm glad to be here.
Jack Christian is an artist and now the equipment manager for the Westlake School of Design at Notre Dame University. Last week at Minnetrista Museum and Gardens, community members had the opportunity to have their portrait captured by photographer Tom Sterkowitz. Our colleague, Michelle Kinsey, found him between sessions to ask him our favorite question. Wei-wo.
Wei-wo.
Tom Sterkowitz, what are you working on?
Well, I'm working on something here at the Minnetrista Museum that I call a one-by-one community portrait. And the reason it has that name is that I do people's photos and immediately almost give them a print, an 8.5 by 11 print, and then make a second one that then goes on a 8-foot-tall wall.
Wow.
That I then call the community portrait, because then that's the summation of all these people and everybody's next to each other. And it's fun to watch people look to see if there's other people they know, or they'll do selfies of their picture next to the wall. So it's portraiture, but it's also this building this community.
Yeah. Oh, so where did the idea come from? How long have you been doing this project, and why? What was the impetus?
Well, actually, about 3 weeks ago, I was at the Nelson Atkins Museum in Kansas City, where I live, and it was 11 years ago that I did the first one of these at the Nelson Atkins. And how it all came about was, there's a photographer in London, goes by the name of Rankin, and he did a project called 1,000 Britons. But for him, he's a fashion photographer, so he turned these everyday people into fashion models.
Oh.
Had somebody do their makeup, clothes they could wear. So I wanted to do something like that, but more with regular people.
Yeah, who they are, yeah.
Yeah, and I was talking with a friend of mine about this, and we couldn't figure out where we could get enough people to make it worthwhile to do it. And just as a happenstance, I was photographing this woman because she's on a board, and we were talking about ideas and things. And she said, well, I'm on this committee at the art museum to come up with different kinds of events. So we'd love to talk to you about this. And so I met with them. And I said, well, I have this idea, and I'm calling it 500 Portraits in 5 Days. And they loved the idea, so they were totally behind it. And we started on a Wednesday, and Thursday and Friday, there was a blizzard that shut down the city.
Oh, my goodness. Of course, right?
So yeah. We didn't know Saturday, Sunday, were people going to stay home? Were they going to come out? But by the end of Sunday, I had done 816 people's portraits.
In a blizzard.
Yeah. Well, wow. Saturday and Sunday, it stopped snowing. Yeah,
but still, I mean, it took some effort to get there, right? In all of the travels and all of the portraits that you've taken, Tom, what have you learned about people, about community?
Well, I think everybody has a personality. Mm-hmm. And I've found that I have the talent of very quickly sizing someone up and knowing like if I can push them or if I can't. And but the other thing is that I'd say 80% of these pictures are one shot.
Wow.
So I do a picture, everybody signs a release. And so I do a first picture of them holding the release, and then that has their name on it, so like the museum can track who that person is. And then they do their picture. And usually it's one shot.
That's amazing. Tell me about photography for you. When did you start? Why photography?
Well, it also goes back to London. Back in 1966, there was a movie called Blow Up, and it was about a London fashion photographer, you know, super cool, drives a Rolls Royce convertible, has this great studio, models there all the time.
Yes.
And I'm convinced that 80% of the photographers my age are photographers because of that movie.
Wow.
Because you wanted to
of course.
Live that
well,
life.
Well, who wouldn't? Yeah.
And I grew up in Chicago. And so I went to the School of the Art Institute there. And after I graduated, I opened a photography studio. And I wanted to do fashion. And in Chicago, there's only so much of that. And mm-hmm. so I did move to New York. Then I moved to Columbus, Ohio. And in the 80s, I was creative director at The Limited.
Wow.
Met my wife there. We adopted our first son there. And then moved to upstate New York. And I continued my, I had a design business. And then ended up, that was when the economy got really bad and just said, okay, it's time to get a job. And Hallmark came through, so we moved to Kansas City. And unfortunately, the tragedy guides the story because we were there 14 months and my wife died of a brain aneurysm.
Oh, Tom.
And the boys were 12 and 6. So I stopped working to raise them. And then I thought, okay, so what do I do? And I thought, okay, we had a house that had a big room. I called it a good room. It wasn't quite a great room, but it was a good room. And it was big enough to have a photography studio. And I wanted to photograph people. So yeah. I just talked to the parents at school and got them to do it and then slowly built up a photography practice that way. Mm-hmm. So now after doing that at the Nelson and then doing that, I maybe do 4 or 5 of these a year.
Wow.
And then in between I do corporate portraits.
Okay. Yeah.
I do my tagline and my website is corporate portraits where people actually look like they have a personality.
Much needed,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
Much needed.
Yeah. Yeah. It's fun for me because everybody brings a new energy.
Yeah. Like you were saying, you know, earlier, everybody has a personality.
Yeah.
Everybody There's has something that's yeah. going to shine
yeah.
In a photograph.
Yeah.
That's beautiful.
So that's been about it. And I always joked the way to be successful is to still be around when somebody finally calls you.
Yeah.
And so that's kind of what's
yes.
been happening with me
yes.
is that now I get, I'd say half the work I do is people that I didn't pitch.
Yeah.
But
they've seen
they
it.
Heard about
and
they, me.
Yep.
And,
absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for coming back to the community. I did it the first time you were here, which was a few years ago.
Yeah.
Wonderful, amazing experience. And so hopefully we'll see you in Muncie again.
Yeah. I'd love to do it.
Thank you so much for your time,
Tom.
Oh,
you're welcome.
Hey, Jen, it's time to look at the arts and culture awesomeness that you can get this weekend and beyond.
Let's do it. Muncie Civic Theater presents Anastasia on the main stage, Friday, August 16th through September 1st. The show is based on the popular animated film, and it has it all. Romance, adventure, mystery. MuncieCivic.org is the place to go for more info.
This Saturday, August 17th, is Free Saturday at the Muncie Children's Museum. Enjoy all the museum has to offer from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m.
That is a great afternoon, the Muncie Children's Museum.
Oh, yeah.
Saturday, August 17th is Larry Palooza Day in Anderson. Enjoy 6 bands, vendors, food trucks, kids activities, and more from 11 a.m. to 7 p.m. at Dickman Town Center. The annual event celebrates the memory of Larry the Can Man Van Ness.
The Delaware County Farm Crawl is this weekend on August 17th and 18th. You can visit participating farms for tours, special events, and more. The event is hosted by West Wind Farm and Fiber in Yorktown. You can find the event on Facebook and other socials.
The Elwood Glass Festival is also happening this weekend. Check out lots of great food, booths, entertainment, amusement rides, a car show, parade, tournaments, and more. Friday through Saturday at Callaway Park.
Glass Festival.
Yeah.
Hmm.
And a car show. What more do you want?
Nice. This Saturday, August 17th, is the Summer Shindig at the Landing at Red Wing near Prairie Creek Reservoir. Live music, camping, barbecue, breweries, and more await partygoers. For more about the Shindig, listen to last week's Pop of Culture at indianapublicradio.org.
The annual Indie Fringe Festival is happening now through August 25th at 6 theaters around Indianapolis. If you've never been to a Fringe show, it's an experience. More than 70 unique shows will be offered this year. You can get all the details at indiefringe.org. And also new this year, in addition to original plays and multiple events, some plays for the first time are offering a pay what you can option. You should definitely check that out.
That is a lot of plays.
It's a lot of theater. Wow. That's why they say do the fringe. It's like a thing you do.
Nice. The $2 tour of the Village is Saturday, August 24th on University Avenue near Ball State University. The event is free and open to all from 3 to 7 p.m. There will be more than 50 vendors, live music by Free Joel and Jerry Barker, a hot pepper eating contest.
Really? That's impressive.
A dunk tank, a prince and princess doggy contest. I live in that neighborhood, and I've been getting voting slips, just so you know.
All right.
Performances by Ball State's Code Red dancers and much more. The first 100 people will receive $2 bills to spend at the Village businesses that will be offering $2 samples and other goodies.
That is a good time for sure. It's There's a lot of festivals with a lot of different unique things happening to go and experience this weekend.
Yeah, if you want to pick one, you will get to do multiple activities.
Multiple things. Hey, do you have an event you want Pop of Culture listeners to know about? Tell us at indianapublicradio.org/popofculture.
Pop of Culture on IPR is made possible in part by the Indiana Arts Commission, the Community Foundation of Randolph County, the National Endowment for the Arts, Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations, and by sustaining members of IPR. Join us at indianapublicradio.org.
And that's our show. This week was produced by our favorite camp counselor, Luke Jones. Our arts calendar was written by Michelle Kinsey, and our show was hosted this week by me, Jen Blackmer.
And me, Kara Duquette. Pop of Culture is a production of Indiana Public Radio, on the about-to-be-more-bustling campus of Ball State University.
Welcome back!